Terry Chadwick is an information systems professional employed by Sask Power. Terry's philosophy of life is defined through the book The Philosophy of Humanism by Corliss Lamont and illustrated through Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek. He describes himself as an atheist, freethinker, humanist, and skeptic. As a divorced father of two wonderful daughters, he aspires to become an example of what it means to be truly human. And he would also like to incorporate a little more risk in his life. Terry?
Thanks, Andrew. So I noticed this morning that you chose a couple of readings that come from Mark. It's interesting to note, and I challenge you, if you have a Bible at home, to go home and read the endings of Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, and contrast and compare, because you'll find that each one is inconsistent with the other. It's also interesting to note that at the end of reading 623, when Mary and the others ran away from the tomb, and they said nothing for they were afraid. So that is where the original, the oldest manuscripts of Mark actually ended. And you'll find in the King James Version and other versions of the Bible that there are additional verses that follow that were added later. And it's interesting to note that, and they said nothing, for they were afraid. So, well, how do we know what happened then? So, anyway, that was a little impromptu. Glad to see Archibald's here to keep me honest. So, he was born on December 25th to a virgin. He was wrapped in swaddling clothes, placed in a manger, and attended by shepherds. He had 12 companions and performed miracles. He was viewed as the Good Shepherd, the Way, the Truth, and the Light, the Redeemer, the Savior, the Messiah. He was known as both the Lion and the Lamb. His sacred day was Sunday, and he was honored by a Eucharist. Baptism was important to the followers of his religion. Following his death, he ascended to heaven. Of course, the individual I'm referring to is Mithra. You were thinking of someone else, perhaps? Mithra was worshipped for hundreds of years before Christianity had become established. Mithraism reached its peak between the 2nd and 3rd centuries CE. It died out at the end of the 4th century. Consider that the Nicene Council, which established the Christian canon, was held in 325 CE. Following the Nicene Council, many pagan writings were destroyed, including the burning of the Library of Alexandria, in an attempt to eliminate evidence of similar or competing saviors. It's not my intent to argue that Christianity was copied wholesale from older religions and traditions. That has been attempted in the past and is criticized by scholars. My approach is to demonstrate that resurrection tales were abundant among ancient pagans and attempt to provide an explanation as to why this is the case. Wikipedia describes the dying and rising God motif as referring to a deity which dies and then subsequently returns, as in resurrected or reborn, in either a literal or symbolic sense. Male examples include Baal, Melkart, Adonis, Eshmun, Tammuz, Ra, Jesus, and Dionysus. Female examples include Inanna, or Ishtar, Persephone, and Bari. I need to point out that the dying and rising God motif is not a widely accepted category, and many, if not most, 20th century scholars have rejected it as being too general and simplifies the differences between the myths. However, the 2nd century Christian apologist Justin Martyr, who lived from 100 CE to to about 165 CE, recognize the similarities between existing myths and the story of Jesus. When we say that Jesus was produced without sexual union, and that he was crucified and died and rose again and ascended into heaven, we propound nothing different from what you believe regarding those whom you esteem sons of Jupiter. Justin went on to argue that these similarities were planted by the devil. For when the Greeks tell that Dionysus was begotten by Semele, and when they relate that being torn in pieces and having died, he rose again and ascended to heaven, do I not perceive that the devil has imitated the prophecy announced by the patriarch Jacob and recorded by Moses? It can be argued that vegetation gods, symbolizing the death and rebirth of vegetation with the cycle of the seasons, are examples of the dying and rising god motif. Persephone is the daughter of Zeus and Demeter, or is it Demeter? She was taken to the underworld by Hades to be his wife. Demeter, who was so distraught, stopped tending the plants and wandered the earth looking for her. Fearful that everyone on earth would starve to death, Zeus visits Hades and finally declares that Persephone's marriage would be null and void as long as she ate nothing from the underworld's gardens. Hades, being sad to see Persephone leave, convinces her to eat from a pomegranate. This consummated the marriage. She is reborn every year to spend spring and summer on the earth and returns to the underworld in the fall. Inanna, or Ishtar, was a Sumerian fertility goddess who entered and escaped from the underworld. There are some who argue that our celebrations of Easter come from rituals which honored Ishtar with eggs. Cuneiform tablets inscribed with this myth around 1500 BCE testify to the age of the dying and rising motif. Ishtar's husband, king, was Tammuz. As a price in winning her return from the underworld, she was required to send someone in her place. After returning to earth, she encountered friends and loved ones and would set each of them free. Finally, when she returned home, she found Tammuz on his throne, not mourning her passing at all. In anger, she chose him to replace her in the underworld. Tammuz's sister is overtaken by grief and offers to replace him for half the year. So every spring, Tammuz is reborn and set free. You can see the parallels of Tammuz's yearly rebirth to the Persephone myth. In Canaanite religion, Baal was part of a cycle of life and death. Baal and Mot are sons of the supreme god El. You may recognize that El is one of the names for the Jewish god. When El favored the death god, Mot, over Baal, the heat of the summer took over and Baal died. He was resurrected when his sister wife kills Mot. Justin Martyr wrote of Apollonius of Tyana, who is possibly the Apollos mentioned in Acts. How is it that the talismans of Apollonius have power in certain members of creation? For they prevent, as we see, the fury of the waves and the violence of the winds and the attack of wild beasts. And whilst our Lord's miracles are preserved by tradition alone, those of Apollonius are most numerous and actually manifest in present facts. Philostratus wrote a biography of Apollonius commissioned by Empress Julia Domna, the wife of Septimus Severus. There are many historical references to this honored man who lived at the time of Jesus and was revered across the Mediterranean. There are actual writings attributed to Apollonius, including entire books. He was a follower of the Pythagorean philosophy and chose to live simply. In fact, he only wore a robe made of linen. His sandals were made from bark. He didn't eat meat, strict vegetarian. He let his beard grow and his hair grow. You can see some similarities between the description of Apollonius and Jesus. There are many parallels between him and the Jesus story, which I'd like to further pursue at some point in the future, but don't have the time to give justice in this talk. The Roman emperor philosopher Marcus Aurelius admired Apollonius, saying, "From Apollonius I have learned freedom of will and understanding. steadiness of purpose, and to look to nothing else, not even a moment, except to reason. Philostratus speaks of Apollonius. And even after his death, he continued to preach that the soul is immortal. But although he taught this account of it to be correct, he discouraged men from meddling in such high subjects. For there came to Tyana a youth who did not shrink from acrimonious discussions and would not accept truth in argument. Now Apollonius had already passed away from among men, but people still wondered at his passing, and no one ventured to dispute that he was immortal. This being so, the discussions were mainly about the soul, for a band of youth were there passionately addicted to wisdom. The young man in question, however, would on no account allow the tenet of immortality of the soul, and said, "I myself, gentlemen, have done nothing now for over 9 months but pray to Apollonius that he would reveal to me the truth about the soul, but he is so utterly dead that he will not appear to me in response to my entreaties, nor give me any reason to consider him immortal." Such were the young man's words on that occasion, but on the fifth day following, after discussing the same subject, he fell asleep where he was talking with them. And of the young men who were studying with them, some were reading books, and others were industriously drawing geometrical figures on the ground. When on a sudden, like one possessed, he leapt, still in a half sleep, streaming with perspiration, and cried out, "I believe thee!" And when those who were present asked him what was the matter, "Do you not see," he said, "Apollonius the sage, how that he is present with us and is listening to our discussion, and is reciting wondrous verses about the soul?" "But where is he?" the others asked, "for we cannot see him anywhere, although we would rather do so than possess all the blessings of mankind." And the youth replied, "It would seem that he has come to converse with myself alone concerning the tenets which I would not believe. Listen, therefore, to the inspired argument which he is delivering. The soul is immortal, and 'tis no possession of thine own, but of providence. And after the body is wasted away, like a swift horse freed from its traces, it lightly leaps forward and mingles itself with the light air. Loathing the spell of harsh and painful servitude which it has endured. But for thee, what use is there in this? Some day, when thou art no more, thou shalt believe it. So why, as long as thou art among living beings, dost thou explore these mysteries?" Here we have a clear utterance of Apollonius, established like an oracular tripod, to convince us of the mysteries of the soul, to the end that cheerfully and with due knowledge of our own true nature, we may pursue our way to the goal appointed by the fates. One day Apollonius met a funeral procession bearing the body of a young girl who had just died. He stopped the procession with these words, "Set down the bier, and I will dry the tears being shed for this maid." In a few moments the maid arose and joined her friends. Apollonius was asked how such miracles were possible, and he answered, "There is no death of anything save in appearance. That which passes over from essence to nature seems to be birth, and what passes over from nature to essence seems to be death. Nothing really is originated, and nothing ever perishes, but only now comes into sight and now vanishes. It appears by reason of the density of matter and disappears by reason of the tenuity of essence, but it is always the same, differing only in motion and condition." Philostratus indicates that upon his death, Apollonius underwent heavenly assumption. In other words, he ascended to heaven alive. Adonis, Attis, Osiris, Eshmun, all examples of additional dying and rising myths, and there are still more. Origen, an early Christian apologist who lived around 182 to 251 CE, considered pagan resurrection stories of heroes risen from their graves as proof of Jesus' resurrection. Richard Carrier notes, "The great abundance of these tales reflects a widespread hope of returning to life within the pagan community. The evidence is overwhelming that one could return to life in the body that died or in an even better body was a commonplace belief among a great many pagans. What matters here is not what the true events were behind all of these stories of resurrected men and women. What matters is that many people clearly believe these were genuine risings from the dead, or that such a thing could and did happen, or were something they could imagine happening. Nor does it matter how much any of these stories resemble that of Jesus, for the relevant underlying concept remains the same: returning to life in a body. Rufus of Philippi, a pagan high priest, died and returned to life on the third day, living long enough to tell his story. Pliny the Elder reports there were numerous such tales believed by many people, even without magic. He says Varro reported on two different occasions seeing a person carried out on a bier to burial who returned home on foot. Besides witnessing the apparent resurrection of his uncle-in-law, Corfidius, the villainous Aridaeus fell to his death but returned to life on the third day to relate his trip to heaven, and was so transformed by what he learned there that he led a life of impeccable virtue thereafter. Timarchus spent two nights and a day in a sacred crypt, during which time he died, visited heaven, and returned. Ultimately, Pliny the Elder says he also knew of cases of persons appearing after burial, but chose not to discuss them because his book was about works of nature, not prodigies. This, nevertheless, proves such tales were transmitted and believed by many people. Any differences there may have been between the many and varied pagan ideas of resurrection and what the Christians taught, which itself varied according to sect, were all minor points of metaphysical detail, not fundamental barriers to the idea of Jesus returning bodily from the dead. Why is dying and rising so common in so many myths? According to Ralph Munday, these myths can be looked upon as variations upon one great human mythical symphony, what Joseph Campbell called the monomyth. An argument is made that these archetypal symbols are psychological projections of the collective unconscious, the need of the human mind faced with the overwhelming specter of imminent mortality to fashion eternal symbols of human resurrection married to the God's victory over the shadowy domain of death. A spiritual transcendence of the physical underworld to the numinous realm of eternal spirit, logos, the human and the divine united in a transcendent marriage of cycles of life, death, and infinite revitalization. This is the role of the dying and reborn God. This is the message to the believer, for they all share a similar pattern. Quoting René Girard, beginning with some violent cosmic or social crisis and culminating in the suffering of a mysterious victim, often at the hands of a furious mob, all these myths conclude with the triumphal return of the sufferer, thereby revealed as a divinity. Munday continues, the human mind is given to project an unconscious archetypal image onto people or objects, creating mythical figures. A mythical image of a God-man who redeems heroically the fragile, fragmented man of his failures or sins and offers an escape, a ray of hope, holds sway over him. When the true nature of the target figure is seen, the projection is shattered into pieces. A fallen idol remains, but the archetypal desire for the human race to achieve ego immortality remains. When one God dies, another is created to replace the deceased object. So has such a belief always been. Likely, it will always remain. In the words of Joseph Campbell, every religion is true one way or another. It is true when understood metaphorically. But when it gets stuck in its own metaphors, interpreting them as facts, then you are in trouble. I view Campbell's monomyth as an allegory for human life, from a miraculous birth, in the sense that each human cannot know of their own, through independence and establishing one's own journey or direction in life, then experiencing tribulations and success, and finally death. If one believes in a deity, Then one must ask, why do I suffer? If my life is a struggle for existence, then I must believe there is something better. Otherwise, I must accept my deity as a cruel bastard. If you're surrounded by death and life is a struggle, what is the most powerful image one could imagine? Perhaps it's the ability to conquer death. Imagine being promised relief from the drudgery and difficulty of everyday survival in the ancient Near and Middle East. The promise of a new body, whether resurrected physically or spiritually. The promise of a new life free of pain and suffering. No wonder the idea of dying and rising was popular. Another compelling benefit of this belief is the promise of reunion with deceased loved ones. This belief also answers the penultimate question of what follows death. As a species, we fear the unknown. Even today, most humans are fearful of that ultimate of unknowns. Fear is a very strong motivator, if not the strongest. Religions tend to remove one fear and replace it with another, or attempt to explain the unknown, but ultimately, other unknowns arise. The idea of life after death answers the question of what happens after we die, but another mystery supplants it. What is the afterlife like? Are you physically resurrected at some point in the distant future? Or are you metaphysically resurrected immediately following death? Is there a heaven and a hell? What about reincarnation? For me, one unknown is displaced by several more unknowns, resulting in increased anxiety. A much simpler answer is nothing follows death. I view it like this. I'm not fearful of the nothingness I experienced before I was born. So why should I fear nothingness after I've died? My personal belief is that there is no afterlife. No heaven, no hell, nothing. What becomes of me after I die is the same as what was before I was born. The funny thing is, I don't fear death. I'm concerned about how I may die, or when, but I don't fear death itself, nor do I dwell on it. It's no different than going to sleep every night. When we sleep, we don't exist to ourselves. Death is like dreamless sleep. I'll leave you with these words. Don't fear death, because fear will prevent you from living. The only reality is this moment. Anything else is a dream. If one focuses on the past, one is lost to the present. If one focuses on the future, one loses sight of what is important now. Live in the now for life's sake. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
Just wondering, in your research, did you come across or consider Cuchulainn, the Celtic prince who sacrificed himself for the welfare of his people?
I came across many that I didn't include. There's Quetzalcoatl as well.
Exactly.
Of course, he's resurrected in a different form. So I tried to stick to ones that were fairly close to.
Yeah. No, I was just wondering if you came across him and if it in any way resembled what you were. Thank you.
Yeah. And there
thank
are.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was wonderfully informative.
There are also Oriental myths as well with regards to dying and rising, which I didn't touch on at all.
I think you should try to be reassured that there probably is something after death, because a friend of mine in Moose Jaw, who, by the way, has MS and has never been able to ski, said that when she dies, she's going to go skiing. And I said, well, is there snow? And she said, oh, yes, if you, there will be snow. So that's, I think, pretty good proof of something.
Well, all I can say is I was with my mother the day she died, and she was in a coma, and she spoke very clearly, and she said, "Mother, I will be a good little girl," and within 2 minutes after that, she stopped breathing. So she was speaking to someone, and it certainly wasn't me. So since then, I have taken great comfort to the fact that it seems to me that somebody comes for you.
Thank you very much. Just an aside. For a very brief period, perhaps 2 years, within the pages of this esteemed magazine called the New York Review of Books, the terms BCE and CE were used in order to date whatever research was being dwelt upon. Recently, we should say the last 5 years, they've simply returned to using Anno Domini or BC, before Christ. The argument simply being, even if you use CE or BCE, you are not living in a different era from the time that Christ was born. So if you want to adopt a Muslim calendar or whatever, perfectly please do. But if you speak within the context of Western civilization, these are the terms that would apply. Secondly, it is a common feature of humanity, wherever we make our living, in every tribe and tongue, on every river, stream, lake, and sea, where people live together to find and search for explanations for their life in the here and now, the past, and the future. Because we're not simply animals eating and drinking and dying. We are not. We have the ability to postulate and think and converse. And so there, out of the experience of humanity, there grows an understanding, a common understanding of this is where we are and where we're going, subject to the cultural environment in which they find themselves and to which they propagate, a new or even an affirmation of the past comes to the fore and acts as a cohesive force. As far as believing in anything, believing in the pagans, you seem to be the common feeling, this is largely a Christian thing, that pagans were the most licentious bunch of people available, the most sinful. They were not in the least. They were not, Pliny the Elder even testifies to the kind of life that they lived, and it's exemplary to Christians, so that they could, whether their books were burned, banned, and how you found access to whoever this person was that you equated at the beginning with Christ, I don't know. I would like to know where you got your stuff from, if it was all burnt in Alexandria. But in any case, be that as it may, it is a common feature to have hope, to have a sense of whatever. And this is the crux of Judaic Christian Islamic thinking. In being human, having the ability to choose. You can strive to it's the greatest good, or you can be the most vile person imaginable. The choice is entirely yours, but you're not without thinking. Thank you.
So I could get into a discussion about the fact that we actually don't have free will, but that would be a whole other talk. So, but I believe a lot of what you said supports my discussion regarding the fact that because humans have self-awareness and are self-conscious, that they feel a need to create an everlasting existence for themselves.
Given the time, I think we'll have to limit it to one more person. And the person I saw was Tom.
Well, I think that if you look at history and writing and artifacts and genetic change, that essentially the human animal has succeeded in developing a personality which is dependent upon architecture, which is a lever in the support of family life, and the manufacture of architecture, which is a leader in the support of work, which is done by the human brain. And things have changed historically in terms of the occupation of the planet, and changed in terms of the practice of feeding ourselves, and it's changed in terms of the fact that it's a method of survival. There are new methods which are available to the progress of medicine and the philosophy of natural philosophy and human philosophy have evolved to support that. And the fact that they say there's nothing new under the sun, discovery is always new and it's always being refreshed. And that's part of the living origin, which is reflected in terms of icons of people or statues, because they represent belief, and truth is another essence of belief. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Terry.